We in.
Welcome, everybody.
Welcome.
To You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about movie and wines. For those of you who don't know shit about one or both of these topics, my name is Jamie Harrison Rubin, and I am the wine guy.
Well, he's Jamie. He says things. I'm Scott. I also say things. Movie's me. Wine's him. I like him. He likes him. We discuss. Maybe we don't agree. Maybe we do. Maybe you tag along and enjoy. Pairings. Pairings sometimes good, usually not good.
But Scott,
here we are.
You drunk?
No. It's like kind of.
You're a little buzzed.
Why? Okay, I'm a little buzzed. I'm a little sweaty. I'm a little bewildered.
You're bewildered.
At your absurdly weird hot takes about pig, which just feels...
I didn't like it, man. Get over it.
It just feels like catnip for you, and instead you're like, I only like my catnip if it's ethically sourced. Me.
I mean, I do like ethically sourced things.
I mean, that was a poor analogy, but you know what I'm saying.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah,
you're... I'm sorry. I'm done with sad white man stories.
You're the woke mob, Jamie, okay? Also, next time we do Zerts and Veg and you start complaining about something, I'm going to remind you that I'm done with sad white man stories. Give Nick Cage a little courtesy, okay?
I mean, I'm a sad white man.
Don't judge a book by its cover, Jamie. I know you don't look past the cover, but on the inside, there's words and stuff.
But, Scott, I can't read those words.
You're not going to ruin this joke by buying into it with me. It's just going to make the fiction richer.
Welcome, everyone, to the sixth and final episode in our mini-series, A Philadelphia Tasting Menu. We talk a lot about food on this show. Scott often complains that I haven't given him food pairings for the wines that I choose, and then on recording, I will say something to the effect of, this wine is better with food, and then Scott gets all puffed up and mad. He gets all mad. So, I thought for this mini-series, we should talk about the thing that wine does go with, which is food.
Food.
So I picked six of my favorite Philadelphia restaurants. I talked to their owners. They decided on a dish for us to showcase, and I paired wines to those dishes.
And then I paired movies to those wines. Not to the dishes, but to the wines.
Yes.
Everyone understands that. Great.
Yeah,
we don't need to go over that again.
Several times.
And the movies that I picked, I tried to stay within a semi-connected theme to what Jamie is doing. And so these movies are in one way or another about the power of food and specifically about meals that are shared.
For our sixth and final dish, I contacted Tova Duplessis, owner and baker at Essen Bakery, James Beard Awards semi-finalist Tova Duplessis. Her little bakery on Passyunk Avenue has been a favorite of mine for years and years, and in particular, the chocolate halva babka has been a thing that I have eaten far, far too much of. Tova makes great black and white cookies. In fact, on the drive up here, I ate one of those.
You son of a bitch. You brought me four dishes from Biology
and
a babka, and you didn't bring me any black and white
cookies.
No
black and white cookies.
You selfish bastard. I like a black and white cookie. I don't want to like dive into a bit here, but I do sincerely, genuinely like a black and white cookie.
So do I.
Right.
I like black and white cookies. One of my favorite things.
It's a great cookie.
That's why I got it. Also, because after my bike ride this morning, my very close to my house coffee shop that I normally grab coffee from was closed, and I was very, very upset. So I also got myself coffee at Essen. And what goes well
was closed.
With coffee?
Oh, that's
a black and white cookie.
That's so sad, Jamie. But I'm all out of fucks to give about sad white boy stories. I can't deal with
your tragedy.
Is this
going to be an ongoing bit? Like anytime I complain about anything, you're done with sad white man stories?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
You awesome. Don't have any empathy for a man whose wife died, so I don't have any empathy.
I have a lot of empathy for him. I just think that maybe he should
coffee
put
at your favorite
a
place.
Little bit of effort into grieving in a healthy way as opposed to just fucking off into
sometimes
the woods.
Sometimes people don't do the things that are healthy for them, and that's what
and
makes them people.
And they lean into their own privilege and do a thing that is not available to other people. And this is not relitigation of pig.
God. Oh my God.
Scotty mad.
Anyway, the babka
Scotty
was
mad,
delicious.
The babka
was delicious.
Super fucking good.
Extremely delicious babka.
And to that babka, I paired the 2018 Keller Rieslaner from the Rheinhessen in Germany. Keller Rieslaner Auslese is available at Crush Wine Co. for $35. You will find it in a 375 milliliter bottle of wine, otherwise known as a half bottle.
That does feel like a lot to me. but I imagine this wine is probably very good. I haven't had any yet.
Dessert, we'll talk about it, and we'll talk about why. Dessert wine is expensive. It right. just is. And this is one of the more affordable ones at this quality level.
All right. Well, sight unseen, having not had this wine before, Jamie just spilled wine all over himself.
God damn it.
He was sniffing. He had like his eyebrow cocked up in the air.
Oh my God.
And then like was about to make some kind of snide comment, but he was still splishing.
I'm so mad about that.
It looks like he's lactating a little bit. It's like a big splash. It's not flattering. It's very funny. Oh, this is great. This makes me happy now.
It's going to be sticky now because it's a sweet wine.
Yep. That's wonderful.
Ruined the rest of my day.
Well, as I was saying before you rudely interrupted me by splashing on yourself.
You could have ignored it. You could have just gone on.
There was no world in which I could have ignored that.
That's
you
fair.
Told me that this wine was luscious, balanced, meaning high acid against serious sugar content, bright citrus, the master at work, and deeply satisfying, to which I paired one of my all-time favorite movies, Jacques Tati's 1967 stone-cold comedy classic masterpiece, Playtime. Playtime is available for your streaming pleasure on the Criterion channel, and you can also VOD it wherever it is you VOD things. But if you like movies and you don't have the Criterion channel, I highly recommend getting the Criterion channel. It's like Netflix, but everything's good.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds great.
It's pretty cool. What if Netflix, but like...
All good
but
things?
But all good things and no shit. Pretty cool.
There's a lot of shit to wade through on Netflix.
Well, and that's the other thing with the Criterion channel. You don't have to wade through shit. The best feature is that it's all curated.
Right.
So like every month, there's a new series of curated programs. Like last month, they just did a blaxploitation program. And it was like 15 movies across the span of like the 70s and early 80s, like blaxploitation boom. They're pulling together interesting things and they give you behind the scenes shit too. You get a lot of commentaries like from the Criterion Edition DVDs and Blu-rays. On Playtime, I watched like a 20-minute video essay about the movie's themes and construction. And like there's interviews and all kinds of great shit. Yeah, the Criterion channel. Check it out. It's lovely. Big fan.
I'll co-sign that.
Yeah. Well, Jamie is borrowing my account right now.
On Scott's account.
Yeah. Well, one of these days we'll wean you off. But in the meantime, we cannot play our carrot and stick segment today.
No carrot, no stick.
Neither carrot nor stick. No one left us a new review in which they would also disclose their favorite Marvel movie to subject Jamie to watching voluntarily that he would then complain about.
And we're all up to date on Scott's bathroom renovation.
Well, because I didn't have any time to do any more bathroom renovating between last week's recording half an hour ago and now.
Right.
So, yeah.
There's
I don't know. Do you have any stupid bullshit that people will hate that we should talk about? Did you watch Black Widow again?
I did not. No, I've forgotten more of that movie since the last time we spoke.
Yep.
Pretty forgettable.
Yep.
Doesn't leave much of an impact.
Nope.
We talked in our movie chat about the creators of that one character getting boned out.
Oh yeah. The Flopew character. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which like. One Yelena of those stories comes out, Yelena something.
Something enough.
Yeah, Russian Flopew.
Yeah.
Yeah, that just happens every time. There's a story about that. Every time there's a new Marvel movie, Hollywood Reporter or one of the others who are like diligently covering that beat are like, oh yeah, here's how Marvel, and not Disney, but like Marvel the comics company, like as a subsidiary of Disney, screws people out of any sense of compensation. For characters that they make millions, if not billions of dollars on. There's a comics creator, I forget who it is now, but he's worked for both Marvel and for DC, and he had a brief cameo in like a DC movie, like the briefest cameo. Like he was like a technician at a computer, you know, three rows back from like the principal actor who actually had dialogue.
Right.
And he has made more money from residuals for that tiny non-speaking role than he made for a series of movies that have used a character that he created in the pages of Marvel Comics.
That is some shit.
That's just how they do. And like, sure, when you work for them, you know, you sign a contract that says, I don't own any of the characters that I create.
Right, but it's pretty predatory to put that contract in front of people to begin with.
This is tricky because like you... If you go to work for a company like that, then like you need to understand, like you're working for for if you go to be a writer on a Star Trek show, you don't own the characters. Like, you're working within an IP world. The people sure. who own the copyright and everything, they own the thing.
Yeah.
But like,
you should be compensated.
There should be something.
Yeah.
And then for the Marvel people to come up with a compensation deal and a special recognition deal and to have numbers. And the thing with this Hollywood Reporter piece is that they just nickel and dime everybody in a completely opaque fashion. And like, oh, we agreed that we would pay each of you $25,000. Actually, we're only going to pay a total of $25,000, and not just between the two of you, but between the two of you and the creators of every other character who signed a similar deal that appears in these movies. So your $25,000 a piece is actually now $5,000.
And the silly thing about all of this is it is just, as Johnny Words put it, these amounts of money are literal rounding errors for this company.
Yeah. Or as I put it more eloquently, you're a fucking subsidiary of the Disney company. Just pay them. Just pay them. Like, the Marvel Comics Corporation is essentially like, you know, they've been financially struggling for whatever. And like, comics and these characters, for as much as they're dominant in pop culture, like, Spider-Man is one of the best-selling comics every month. And like, if it breaks a million issues sold, it's a huge deal. Like, this is a fairly niche sub-industry, right? But it is feeding an enormously dominant pop culture like empire.
Right.
Just fucking pay them. And then these people will be happier to keep generating IP for your content slurry.
Yep.
It's bad news. So anyway, if you want to go back to hearing more about my bathroom or my other home renovation projects, keep not leaving us reviews. If you want to hear actual talk about Marvel movies and not just all the dirty ways that that company is shitty and fucking awful to the people who create stuff for them, you can leave reviews on Apple Podcasts and several other review leaving platforms. And if you leave a review and say your favorite Marvel movie, Jamie will subject himself to it and we'll talk about it on the air at a future date. But for today, we should move on.
Yes.
No one wants to hear this, including us.
Booed.
Booed. Jamie,
we just had some slices of chocolate halva babka.
There's more downstairs, and I regret not eating it now.
Well, the mouth sounds of eating on mic.
Pretty poor.
Not great.
But it was delicious.
Yep.
Chocolate and halva in one.
Yep.
I'm a big fan of halva.
Yeah, me too.
My wife got me onto halva when we lived down near Rehoboth, and there was like an Israeli like import, you know, food goods store that we would go to. And she would just like, there would always be like a pack of halva sand in the house. Halva is so special. It has like a gritty but buttery texture.
It's so fatty because it's essentially ground sesame seeds.
Yeah. And just all the oils in there. Yeah. But yeah. Halva and chocolate in like a bready cake.
Yeah. So for those of you who don't know, babka is a food of the Jewish diaspora. It's essentially enriched dough or brioche dough. That's rolled flat out onto a surface and then covered with whatever filling and then sort of twisted all around itself and put into a tin, like a loaf tin for baking. And the one that Tova and her team at Essen make has been a favorite of mine for years. It's sort of the flagship thing that they do there. And she took, you know, months ahead of time formulating this recipe before they opened. And she admitted to me as we were texting back and forth about this dish and about the bakery, that they make tweaks all the time, that they're just always trying to make it better.
Is that feels blasphemous to tweak your recipe? Is that commonplace in bakeries?
I think it depends on the ethos of the particular person.
Yeah.
I think it's both really cool to adhere to a specific recipe and do it the same every time and to constantly iterate and try new things and try and make it better and strive for perfection each new time.
Yeah. So to be clear, I don't think it's blasphemous, but it feels like, let's say, up their own ass restaurant people who have very rigid expectations of what a restaurant is and what someone who works in a restaurant is and can't accept that maybe somebody from a different experience might come into fine dining restaurants from a different point of view and for a more callous reason than that maybe somebody should lean on their community more before taking their grief and leaving Portland behind to go live with their beloved pig.
Scott is so mad that I didn't like pig.
Some people might think it is somehow shady or breaks the social bonds to change your recipe. I'm perfectly fine with it in pursuit of perfection and improvement.
I'll say this as someone who's eaten this babka a lot over the years, it continues to get better. it continues to get more flavorful and more complex and just better over time. And I think it's great that they're constantly trying new things with this product that is, that you would think is just one recipe locked in because it's such a staple of the location.
Are there people who have beef like, oh, like, you know, like sometimes I'll go to a place and it's like, oh, they change chefs or they change recipes and I don't like it anymore. But you think this is an improvement. You think that there's like some neighborhood stalwart who's like, oh, I like the babka better when it wasn't probably. This good.
Yeah, probably. I've never met them. I've never heard it. Anytime I mention Tova's cooking, baking to anybody, they're like, oh my God, I love that place.
The babka. You got to have the babka.
you got to have the babka.
Yeah, that's really good. I am hoping that Jamie gets just buzzed enough by the time this recording is over to forget that he left half a babka in the fridge, and then it will be my babka.
I'm intending to leave it here with you and your family.
All right.
I live very close to Essen Bakery. You should have the babka. Because I love you and I love your family.
No, I deny you. I'm getting the babka because of sleight of hand and trickery. That's why I'm getting the babka. I've fooled you. And I claim the babka as mine own, and it is my right.
Sure. Great.
Excellent.
Now we're going to fight about it later. Now I'm going to try and take it home, and we're going to have
a... son of a bitch. You're going to try and take my babka out of my fridge.
Out of your house.
That I fought and deceived for.
That's right.
Anyway, it's delicious.
It's so
good. Didn't have it with the wine. Is it? We should have done that.
We probably should have, but we didn't want to bring glasses out by the pool, and we were enjoying it with your wife and your son and your father-in-law.
And we don't do glassware by the poolside.
So Scott is looking bewildered about his first sniff of this wine.
I am nosing the wine.
Yeah.
I encountered a real person in the wild, a non-wine person, who when I was describing the podcast to him, he was laughing, thought it was very funny. And he's like, so like, what are you guys just like, you sit around and like you drink the wine and like you're nosing it. And I'm like, yes, we're nosing it. I know what that means now.
That's funny.
Boy, wow. All right. This is a provocative funk out of this glass.
So a thing that I forgot about Keller Wines, and I'm sorry, Scott.
Oh, good.
We should have opened this hours ago.
How long until it tastes good, Jamie?
It tastes good now. It'll smell good in hopefully by the end of the episode.
Oh, what is that smell?
It's sulfur dioxide.
It's a sulfur. Yeah. It's a very, almost like a synthetic, like a burnt plastic smell.
Yep. It stings the nostrils.
Mm.
Yeah.
Ooh.
It's not pleasant. So.
Oh my God. It tastes so good.
Right?
It tastes like the opposite of what it smells like. Oh boy. Wow, I'm sorry I doubted you, wine. You know what? No, I'm not. You invited doubt.
Yeah.
Oh, so, wow, that's terrible on the nose.
They put a bunch of sulfur at bottling because they want to preserve the wine. They want to make sure it doesn't re-ferment. There's a ton of sugar still in here. You know, I don't think that they should use as much sulfur as they do, but that's just my opinion. Take it as you will. This is a relatively young wine. If this were, you know, 10 years older, we wouldn't have this presentation of really heavy sulfur. But for right now, it's going to take a while to blow off, which is a shame because this wine should be showing us like really, really like rich aromas of ripe apples and citrus and like honeysuckle and ginger. But it's really very much obscured by the sulfur, by that like sharp, piercing stank.
All of those notes are in the mouth, though.
They are.
Mouth detects honeysuckle and ginger, a little bit of ginger.
Yeah, like candied ginger almost.
Like candied ginger, obviously very sweet.
Yep.
There's a citrusy thing, kind of like a lemon thing, in the realm of like the candied ginger, like a candied lemon thing.
Mm-hmm. Like candied zest.
Yeah, super bright. And citrusy. Is this high acid?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, this is very acidic, right? Yep.
Even against, and like the sugar plays down our perception of the acid, that sort of that balancing act.
Yeah.
Those two play against each other. So if this, let's say, had been fermented completely dry, the presentation of the acid would be like shocking and piercing and borderline unpleasant. But the way it's presenting now against the sugar is like really, really nice and kind of clears your palate of the like without the acid, you would just have syrup laying on your tongue.
Yeah. This is full bodied as well, right?
Yeah.
Syrupy and thick.
Yep.
Is the acid the source of the burning in the back of the throat?
I think so. Yeah.
There's just a hint of a burn little bit as it goes down.
Yeah. It's high acid.
Not unpleasant. The burn.
Yeah.
The back of throat burn. God, it smells terrible, though.
The fucking sulfur, man.
You have done this wine no favors.
I didn't. I feel really bad. I stuck my nose in it before you did, and I was like, God damn it. Maybe it'll blow off, and it really just is not. It's so disappointing. I'm trying to, like, feverishly swirl my glass to introduce oxygen in here
Don't spill none on you now.
Well, yeah. It'll come around.
Well, I'm not here for the nose, Jamie. I'm here for mouth, okay? And mouth is enjoying this wine.
I'm here for mouth. Don't say that out of context.
It's like what I want a lemon to taste like. Like if lemon yes. were a fruit that yeah. you could take a bite out of. Have we had this conversation on the show before? Have I made that comparison about wanting to take a bite out of a lemon?
I don't think so. I'm not recalling.
At a certain point, we're going to run out of things to say about wine. Movies are infinite in the depths that can be plumbed and discussed.
I'm going to slap you in public.
Eventually, we will have drunk all the types of grapes and from all the countries, old world and new, and we'll have nothing else to say. And we'll just keep repeating ourselves.
As though we haven't already repeated ourselves about both wine and movies.
It's already starting to smell better.
Yeah, my last sniff, I got that like candied ginger, the florality also.
But the funk of ginger, the smell, there's like funk might be just a catch-all term that I use for any kind of like low-end notes that I can't describe.
But yeah. The bass note, maybe the...
There's a bass note on nose of ginger.
Yeah. It's getting there. It will come around, hopefully sooner rather than later. It's nice that this is a 2018 and not the 2020 that also is available.
Because
we're farther removed from the dose of sulfur, so it has dissipated a little bit. Oh, so
the 2020. Now, with the 2020, you would need to age longer, or you just give it more time when you open it?
But either.
Either.
Yeah.
What kind of alcohol are we talking about here?
I should have looked at the label.
It's not that far away.
But it's far enough that you could just Google it. Yeah.
The label is a solid 4 feet away from both of us, but I'm going to let Jamie Google it instead.
So this wine is 8% ABV. It's on the low end.
8%.
That's just because fermentation gets stopped before all of the sugar, you know, that sugar just gets left in there. They're not adding sugar back to the wine after a fermentation.
Fermentation gets stopped.
Yep.
Because we're out of yeast or because they interrupt the process?
Because they interrupt the process.
By adding?
Either sulfur or by cooling the tanks.
So the sulfur is there not just to prevent further fermentation, but to arrest fermentation.
That's right.
As well.
But the sulfur that we're perceiving is specifically the sulfur added at bottling.
At bottling, just to prevent further fermentation of the sugar.
Correct.
Does that happen with a lot of sweeter wines, like not just dessert wines?
Yep.
They do a lot of sulfur.
That happens with a lot of wines. We haven't really encountered it on this show because I tend towards lower intervention, less additive kind of things. And while I don't think sulfur is a sin, I think that they have done too much here.
But am I tasting the sulfur?
No, you're just smelling it.
All right, shut up. Preemptively, shut up.
Okay, I'm shutting up.
What is sulfur? In terms of it being added here, is it added as a gas? Is it added as a solid particulate? Is it added as a liquid?
Solid.
It's a solid.
Yeah.
And sulfur is like a yellow powder mineral, right?
Yep. Well, we're not adding the sulfur mineral. We're adding sulfur dioxide, or more specifically, the form that it gets added to in wine is, I should know this off the top of my head because I've done it. Potassium metabisulfite is how it's added.
Potassium metabisulfite.
Correct. And so the two sulfite ions that break off from that molecule when they get dissolved in liquid are what we're perceiving.
Okay. Well, I like it. Whatever it is that led to it being like this, it is good. Jamie, congratulations.
Six out of six.
This is the first time you've done 6 out of 6 for a miniseries.
It is getting better. The nose is getting, it's clearing up.
Well, I'm still talking here about me and my experience.
You've
done 6 out of 6. I thought I was going to be in the clear with a 6 out of 6 on this miniseries on my side of things. Because I feel like I won you over on Midsummer from your wrong stance that the men are the victims in that movie. But then Pig, you just had to come at it. You had to come in from this extreme, redonkulous hot take angle. And fine, I guess I respect your opinion.
You guess.
But yeah, so I guess I'm 5 for 6 because obviously Playtime is an undisputed masterpiece and no one in this room would dispute it in my house.
No, I had trouble with Playtime while I was watching it. Because I had no idea what the fuck was happening. Like, am I looking for a narrative? I spent so long trying to find a narrative.
Well, you were looking for love in all the wrong places, that's my correct. Friend. Let's save it. I'm digressing just to digress, but we'll save the movie.
I'm glad that talk you about like this movie. Wine.
It's very tasty.
It's from the Rheinhessen.
And you love saying Rheinhessen.
The Rheinhessen, yeah? Das schmeckt gut. So just briefly, the Keller estate is run by a guy named Klaus-Peter Keller and his wife, Julia. They're really responsible for bringing the Rheinhessen from a place where you make kind of whatever bulk idiot wine.
Plonk? Is it plonk?
It's plonk.
Do we spell plonk differently in Germany? Is it like a P-L-A with an accent, N-K?
Yes, sure.
Plonk. Wait, that's the plank
like, length. You probably have never heard of a wine called Blue Nun, but I'm certain that your father-in-law, Steve, has. It's from a generation back, and it was like garbage wine made in the Rheinhessen and packaged in blue bottles and sold very inexpensively and drunk in massive quantity.
Well, I like the blue bottle idea.
Yeah, it's cool or whatever.
Nice to shake things up. No more of this olive green shit.
But Klaus-Peter had correctly identified that there are great places to grow great wine and focuses on specifically dry wines, although obviously is quite adept at making a really great sweet wine.
This one is very, very wet. Bringing back the classics, everybody. Digging into the archive. I lulled you into a false sense of security God by not it. Making any champagne jokes with our sparkling white last time.
I really...
But then here we are.
Ay, ay, ay.
It's a wet wine. It's not dry.
It is wet.
It's wet.
Sure. So the focus is on Riesling, and they make really beautiful Rieslings. They make some of the rarest Rieslings in the world. There's a wine that he makes called G-Max. They also have some pretty whimsical names to the wines, including G-Max.
G-Max. It sounds like a sex toy.
It does. It's one of the rarest wines in the world. I've never had the privilege of tasting it. I hear it's very good. But it's like veiled in secrecy and Klaus-Peter won't tell anyone where the grapes come from specifically. Like there's like a plot within a vineyard that it comes from, but it's like a closely guarded secret or
it's
whatever.
Like Area 51 on Google Maps. It's right. Just like a gray rectangle that's just blocked out.
It's fucking weird.
That's dumb.
But like the other wines are spectacular. I just drank, I had purchased 2 bottles of his, Spätburgunder Rosé. Spätburgunder is German for Pinot Noir. I knew you were going to hate that one.
It's fine. It's fine. The Germans are allowed to have their own name for Pinot Noir. That's fine. Wait, if the Germans are allowed to call it something else, why do I have to say it in French? I mean, I don't mind. Everybody gets their own rules. It's okay.
That's right.
There's no rules.
The reason why you say it in French is because the French have dominated wine.
Right.
French colonialism.
But the Germans will not acknowledge French dominance.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that rosé, 2 weeks ago, at my Monday wine pop-up at Southwark, I was concurrent to my thing at Southwark. There was a fundraiser for a local industry bartender who had, been involved in a hit and run accident. He was hit on the street by a car and then ended up having a stroke and is still in intensive care.
Fuck.
They raised something like $50,000 for him that night.
Wow.
You know, I said it on Instagram that I would pull a bottle from my cellar and give a little taste to anyone who had been to his event fundraiser. Chose the Keller Pinot Noir because it's so rare and, in my opinion, so incredibly delicious. And I was really, really happy to share it, although now I don't have any more and I'm very sad.
Well, mistakes were made, Jamie.
Yeah, the Keller wines are great. I love them. I wish that the top end ones were a little bit more available and a little bit less opaque, but they do really good work. And it's cool that they brought this region into the forefront, into the conversation of, you know, top end wines. Cause it could have just ended up like the Central Valley of California, which is largely planted to like industrial farming kind of things where they spray a ton of shit and they just crop for big yields and garbage wine. And now people are a little bit more focused on good agriculture. And I think that's a good thing.
This is a Rieslaner.
Yes. Rieslaner. Rieslaner is a crossing of Riesling and Silvaner. Silvaner is another white grape. You find it more often in Alsace than you do in Germany, but a significant amount of it is planted in Germany, mostly in the Franken, which is south of the Rheinhessen.
Wait, is this a blend of those two grapes, or
it
is this
a
like
crossing?
So like a hybrid,
yes,
of the two species.
They're both the same species.
The two strains.
The two varieties.
So this is a wine mule.
Sure.
Yeah.
Except a mule is a result of the crossing of two different species.
That's what I just said.
Right. This is not a mule. This is like a mutt.
If you breed
a Jack Russell Terrier with a Chihuahua, you get a different dog that is not either of those dogs.
I'm working on a portmanteau of Jack Russell and Chihuahua.
Jack Wawa.
No.
Chur Russell.
Now I just want a churro. That sounds pretty good. No, I got nothing. I got nothing. You got nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the dog portmanteaus have probably been come up with
and
at this point.
The poodle ones are annoying.
Well, poodles in general. Kind of annoying.
Poodles are great dogs.
Are they?
They really are. Like, great disposition, really, like, calm, loving, loyal. Like, poodles are great.
Jamie, that's why cartoons have taught me anything, poodles are up their own ass.
Right. Cartoons are wrong. Cartoons are just going on the look of the poodle.
Wow.
Because the traditional grooming style of the poodle makes them look that way. But poodles themselves are really, really fabulous dogs. And that's why there are so many poodle crossings out there that are so fashionable, because those dogs end up having really, really calm dispositions.
Jamie?
Yes.
These poodle crossbreeds that you love so much, these poodles, these dog owners, none of it's real.
Get the fuck out of
none
here.
None of it's real, Jamie.
Scott's not going to let this go that I didn't like Pig.
I'm just really surprised between you not liking the movie about, you know, returning to the site of trauma, which is the restaurant industry of fine dining, and saying that cartoons are wrong. I feel like I don't know you anymore. I just don't know who you are. Next thing, you're going to renounce Muppets, and then all bets are off.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
I don't know. Let's give it time.
Ay. So yeah, it's a crossing of Riesling and Silvaner. I don't know exactly to what end this crossing was made. My guess is that Silvaner is a higher cropping variety than Riesling is. So the idea may have been to get more grapes of a higher quality, because Silvaner is very much seen as like a secondary grape.
But it yields a lot.
Yeah. But this crossing really didn't take hold. It's not particularly common. You see it here and there, and mostly to make botrytized sweet wine.
What now? Botrytized?
Botrytized.
Botrytized?
Affected by botrytis.
All right.
This is not a Johnny Words in Memoriam segment.
You've discussed botrytis before. I've heard you say the word botrytis before.
Yes, I have. That's true. Okay, so Johnny Words in Memoriam
segment. Johnny Words.
Rest in peace.
Devout listener. Hater of all good things about Star Trek.
Ooh, the nose on this wine is good now.
Oh, is it good now? I'm tired of talking about Johnny Words. Nope. Still funky.
Mine has come around to like apple skin and lemon zest and ginger and lilies.
Nope. Mine is giving me a sense memory flashback to, do you remember 1988 or 1989? The Land Before Time.
Yeah.
The fast food tie-in toy was Pizza Hut had little like latex puppets of all the dinosaurs from The Land Before Time. I had all of those. And at the apartment that I grew up in, one of them, I forget which one, it might have been Sarah, but got left on like the electric like baseboard or like the radiator heater. And we came home and it was just a stinky melted puddle.
Oh, that's terrible.
And that's what I'm smelling right now is 4-year old me crying over a melted dinosaur child.
These are the things that that sense memory. Damn, that was you took it back. Mm. It'll get there. Leave the wine alone. Anyway, Johnny Words in Memoriam.
Johnny Words in Memoriam to honor dearly departed friend Jay Words. We intone his favorite thing about the show before he passed. When I asked Jamie to explain something that Jamie has previously explained, so you have not explained. But botrytism.
Botrytis.
No, the thing.
Botrytized.
Botrytized is new, but botrytis you have explained.
Right. Botrytized is just a different word to describe something that is affected by botrytis.
It's been botrytisized, yes. But what is botrytis again? Is it a fungal
botrytis
thing?
Is a fungus.
It's fungal pressure.
That's right.
So obviously we have discussed botrytis before.
Yes.
Okay, great.
But botrytis is the good fungus.
But if it's been botrytized, it's bad
fungus?
No,
it's good. Okay. If you let it go too long, then it becomes gray rot and it's bad.
And that's bad
fungus. It's the same species of fungus, but the good botrytis gives you that sort of like ginger, honeysuckle character on a wine and also leaches out extra moisture from the grapes, concentrating the sugars to allow for a much sweeter wine.
I'm glad that happened.
Yeah.
I'm glad it was botrytized. Bastardized. Yeah,
it's real fucking good.
Pop quiz, place this in the canon of sweet wines we have talked about on the show. You can't this is the first one.
Yep.
Why have we not done more sweet wines?
Well,
do you not like things that are botrytized?
No, I really like dessert wine.
And dessert.
One reason is sweet wine is very expensive.
I appreciate that.
Another reason is I largely don't think about it when we're talking. Like dry wines are what I want to drink on the regular. This isn't really a wine that I want much more than a glass of. There's a lot of sugar here.
Yeah.
It gives you that like back of the throat kind of like, I've had a lot of candy or whatever feeling, which I don't necessarily want unless I'm having a little bit with a dessert. And that's why it's here now up against the chocolate halva babka.
And we dabbled in this recently. So we do dessert wine with dessert.
Yeah.
Because you don't want the food that you're eating with wine to be sweeter than the wine.
Right.
So this wine is sweeter than the babka.
Correct.
Is there like a sweetness scale? Is it like a Scoville's thing with hot sauce? Can we numerically measure the sweetness of a thing?
Degrees bricks.
And what does that measure? Is it like sugar content
the
per
amount
gram?
Of sugar or? In solution. Yeah, I don't actually know what the metric is, but it's what it bricks is generally what winemakers use to describe sugar content.
Man, you have an answer for everything sometimes. I don't approve of that. No, I mean, I guess I do approve of that. It makes the show better. And then I learn things, in theory.
Yeah, I think that sweet wines like this I may have overlooked some of them for, you know, certain movies that we've done. I don't know. I'm trying to think of a movie that we've done that would have really benefited from something sweet like this.
Eurovision?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
That's like kind of an immediate.
It might have been a sugar rush overload, but Teen Titans Go to the Movies.
Oh my God.
Could have gone well with a very sweet wine.
Yeah.
But might have been too much.
It would have been a lot.
The kids would have liked it more though.
An off dry wine. We don't give the kids wine, sweet or otherwise.
I was just testing you. It took you a second. You passed the test, Jamie.
Thank you.
Barely.
Yeah. Teen Titans Go to the Movie. That one. That's like having a Coca-Cola and Pixie Sticks.
Yeah, it's a hat on a hat. It's a little bit too much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. It's tasty. Does it pair with Playtime? I don't know.
I don't know about it either.
I don't know, because the thing is, Playtime is not a short movie.
No.
And this, I truly do not want another glass of this afterwards. And it's delicious.
It's delightful, but it's like, I want three... 5 ounces maximum of this at a time.
Well, I can't know unless it's in a measuring cup. I don't know how many ounces.
I poured you about 5 ounces.
That might have been too much.
Right.
It's the sugar and I'm already starting to get a bit of a headache there, but that might be the sulfur, right? People get headaches from sulfur sometimes.
People do, yeah.
But also, other than babka, I've really just had been drinking since lunchtime today.
Yep.
But yeah, it could be that. And the sugar and the viscosity too. Yep. Like there's only so much, you know, Coke syrup I can take.
Yep, I agree. And this is also why I haven't paired more sweet wines.
Well, that is a reasonable reason.
We didn't get into why sweet wines are expensive. If you'd like to discuss that.
I mean, I just felt like this is an oversight on your part and not on mine.
I mean, usually you would ask me about that.
Because I sometimes get tired of asking the same questions, Jamie. Like, why does it cost so goddamn much? And why do we just make up words for what they're called? But I already did that one today.
Yeah.
Why are sweet wines expensive?
Sweet wines are expensive for different reasons, depending on the method of production.
Of course.
Specifically for this, for botrytized sweet wines, it's risky. It's really, really risky to leave your fruit on the vines for long enough for botrytis to develop. You may end up overshooting and going to gray rot, which ruins it and you can't use it for wine anymore. But also this lengthens the amount of time that you are harvesting grapes. You know, if your dry wines are all in the winery by, let's say, mid-September, and you don't harvest for your botrytized wines until, you know, mid-October, that's extra staff that you have around. That's extra cost. And there's also just like tiny amounts of it because there's less water. You're literally leaching the water out of all of the grapes. So it's about there being less of it. It's about the labor and it's about the risk.
Is that why it's syrupy? Because there's less water in each grape?
Yep.
And not because there's sugar added.
Correct.
Is there any sugar added to this? So
this is all natural from the grapes.
Oh, natural.
Yep.
All right. That's pretty reasonable. Increase your risk tolerance, literally generating less juice, even with more grape, with whatever this is called, Rieslinger.
Yep.
I will allow for the increase in cost, especially since this bottle will last me longer than most bottles will.
Right. You'll have a glass at the end of a night, or like 2 ounces at the end of a night, as a little taste.
Yeah, this is not shot glass wine, but I have those two little wine glasses that we got from the vineyard where we got married. Those are nice dessert wine glasses.
They are.
Are they dessert wine glasses?
Yeah, the port glasses or whatever. But I tend to like to enjoy, and we've talked about this, all wines out of like an all-purpose wine glass. I like to be able to introduce more oxygen, and those little glasses don't allow you to do much swirling.
Not a lot of room.
Not a lot of room even for your nose to like get in there and smell the damn thing.
Speaking of, let's check. Let's see.
Check back in.
Nope. Not good.
Mine's continuing to get better, although there is some hanging on, some of that sulfur stank.
Nope. Just getting burnt plastic now. Burnt plastic and sad child dreams when I found out that no, we're not going back to Pizza Hut this week.
Pizza Hut. Fond memories of being a shitheel delivery driver at Pizza Hut.
Oh, I'm just thinking about, do you remember when Pizza Hut had like a weekday or maybe it was a weekend, but they had a buffet?
Yep.
Like a pizza buffet?
Absolutely.
They had dessert pizza. There was like a blueberry pizza. I vaguely remember the salad bar, but I remember dessert pizza.
When I was working Harvest up in the Finger Lakes, I would go shopping at a Wegmans in Corning. And on the way there was an old abandoned Pizza Hut that was like for sale. And you know how those buildings are shaped. They built them
very
all the same way.
Specific,
very
yeah.
distinctive. And every time I'd pass it, I'd be like, what if I opened a restaurant in an old Pizza Hut? Like a pizzeria in an old Pizza Hut.
Exclusively pan pizzas.
Yeah,
made with the finest local ingredients.
And with like a bomb fucking wine program.
You know what? Pizza Hut gave it a bad rap. I don't fundamentally have an issue with the pan pizza.
No.
There is a time and a place for it.
Oh, yeah. The Chicago deep dish, on the other hand.
Well, that's a casserole. That's a different thing. That's not the same. And it's delicious. My mom used to make, I was thinking about this because with watching Pig, the excellent, superlatively beautiful and thoughtful and profound Pig.
A sad white man who can't deal with his emotions.
I'm Jamie. I've got to broadcast my fucking progressive values. Hashtag progressivism. Hashtag Jamie. Hashtag not all Jamies. Hashtag wine.
I don't even know what you're making fun of me for right now.
You exactly. Exactly. Anyway, I was thinking about with Pig and like the Adam Arkin Anton Ego moment.
Yes.
That like flashing back to sense memories. And I have a strong sense memory of this casserole pizza that my mom made. I recall it only being once. But she says that she made it for a while and then I just stopped liking it. And my recollection was always that she made it once and it was unbelievable. And that every time she made it after that, it wasn't as good. And so I was just disappointed. And she was like, do you want me to make the deep dish casserole pizza? I was like, yeah. And I look forward to someday very casually making some kind of comment like that to my child and giving him baggage that he carries forth into the post-apocalyptic future.
Into the wasteland.
Yep. Into Waterworld.
Should we talk about this movie?
Well, so you don't like it because you're dumb.
No, I do like it.
I feel bad because it's hard enough to like schedule things. And when you come up here and we do things like we have enough recordings to do and then you have to worry about parking and then there's a child and bedtime is always so late. I had an inkling that we should make time to have you watch Playtime here
on
my home theater because it is such a big screen movie. Because it's almost all wide shots.
Yeah.
There's a handful of medium shots, no close-ups in the entire movie. And it's all about these like densely populated frames. And there's movement happening in the frame at all times in all different places.
It's like if Where's Waldo book was moving.
Yeah. And everything is orchestrated and choreographed. And you can look anywhere in the frame and there's a little story happening, a little story of behavior. And if you're just watching it on a small TV, I can imagine it feeling crowded and kind of exhausting. And I find it liberating to watch something where it's like, I can look wherever I want. No one's telling me what I'm looking at. They'll suggest it with a sound cue or with emotion or with a color. You can look anywhere in the frame and there's always something to look at. There's always something going on.
I struggled in the beginning part of the movie because I was looking for a narrative. I was looking for a character. I was looking for anything that is conventional.
Right.
Right. It took me a while to get with the language of this movie, but once I did, I had a blast. Like, you're right. It's just, you can look anywhere and you make your own experience with this movie. And that the fucking restaurant scene.
The restaurant God. Scene. So this is why I picked it for the miniseries. So let's do it. Let's set the table here, everybody. So we're talking about Playtime. This is a 1967, I think, and I'm not alone, masterpiece from the all-time great French comedy auteur Jacques Tati. In the film, Tati reprises his signature on-screen character, the bumbling and amiable Monsieur Hulot. Playtime follows Hulot and an American tourist, Barbara, played by Barbara Denick, on their parallel journeys in the glass and steel New Paris. Both of them lost in a sea of identical gray high-rises, tacky American tourists, and absurdist wealth-signifying conveniences of modern living. There is basically no plot to speak of. It's just a series of exquisitely staged, nearly silent comedy set pieces. Though it was a huge commercial failure upon its original release in 67 in Europe and then finally 73 in the US, Playtime is considered one of the great movies. In the 2012 Sight and Sound poll, it was ranked like number 43 greatest film of all time. It is currently, as previously said, available to stream on the Criterion Channel, and you can VOD it, and you should watch it, because it's singular. There's nothing else like it. Like, even in Tati's, like, body of work and the other, like, Monsieur Hulot films, like Monsieur Hulot's Vacation or Mon Uncle, like, those are great, and the character and the sense of humor and the sensibility is there. But they're never on this scale. Like, the scale of the canvas is fucking bananas in this movie.
This must have been a challenge to film.
Well, it took 3 years to shoot it.
There you go.
They had 364 shooting days over nearly 3 years.
Holy fuck.
Yeah. The sets were partially destroyed by storms. It cost, I think at the time, 17 million francs. Tati went bankrupt from the movie. They kept having overages in schedule and budget, and he kept putting more and more of his own money in it. He lost the rights to all of his films because of this movie's commercial failure. He lost his house.
Jesus.
It is one of like the great auteur like boondoggles of all time, except that it is a fucking singular work of art.
I'm assuming he has passed away at this point.
He has been dead for quite some time. Yeah.
Did it ruin the rest of his life?
He, I think, made one film after this one, but he always said that this was his last film. Like, this was the last thing that he poured everything into. And then he continued to work just to fucking pay off his debts.
Right.
So the city that we see, right, the movie starts at a recreation of Orly Airport outside of Paris. This was apparently like 7 years before De Gaulle opened up.
Okay.
But so they couldn't film in the real airport because it took forever to film any single scene in this movie. So they built a recreation of like a terminal at the airport and filmed a little bit outside. And then once they get into Paris, which like the whole movie is about this modernizing, Americanizing influence that is just turning every city into the same city, and they're all just gray glass and steel, right? And they all look exactly fucking identical.
It felt pretty pointed that there's a lot of switching between languages and English. Like at one point they're speaking German, but they're flipping back and forth between German and English and then French and English. And that felt pretty pointed.
Well, and then we just watched that American tourist group that just like bounds around, and they're all just so excited to be here in Paris. And like we see repeatedly in the reflections of opening doors, oh, there's the Arc de Triomphe, there's the Eiffel Tower.
Right.
But these people are just excited to hang out in this like couple of blocks of like a very ultra modern glass and steel area,
which is essentially like a shopping mall and then a restaurant,
a shopping mall and a restaurant and a hotel and a couple of blocks. All of that was a set built for the movie. They built the first two stories of every building in that area. And only the first story for most of those buildings is actually like a full set that they would then film also inside. The second stories are largely super high-res photographs actually taken from like there's real high-res photographs of the real airport that are then blown up and just put up to make fake interiors, and then they wouldn't create reflection issues. All the high rises that you see, I couldn't figure out watching it because I'm like, I know that they built all the sets and I know that they filmed this like out in like, you know, some like flat land, essentially far away from the city. And I don't understand where these, we keep seeing like what look like the same skyscrapers, like everything, like any fucking major city that you go to now, they're just all the same fucking high rise condo buildings that are going up. And I couldn't figure out how they built them. And every time I think like, oh, well, that's obviously a matte painting, like somebody would cross the frame in such a way that would prevent it from being a matte painting. They built forced perspective skyscrapers. They built, I think, two or three of them that were 15 meters high.
Oh my God.
That they were on wheels and they could just move them around the set. So they would always be like at the end of a block. And so it always looked like the same building, but then it was built at three sides and all of it was lit. Those buildings were all lit. All of the sets and the buildings and the restaurant and the drugstore and the hotel, all of it was lit. They had to build a power plant to supply the sets for this movie. It was so insanely expensive.
And then it flopped.
And then they lost their U.S. distribution. Oh, like, he apparently largely made it for the U.S. market, and then they lost their U.S. distributor. He filmed it on like very expensive 70 millimeter film stock because he wanted to play to a huge canvas and have all these like densely populated little scenes and all these little characters in the background. And then when it played in the US, finally, like it had to be duped down to a 35 millimeter print. So like it took years for the movie to be properly seen and appreciated. But yeah, like it broke him.
It's so beautiful.
It's so gorgeous. Just to watch any scene, like even if you're not laughing at what's going on, just the way that movement happens across the frame, the way that characters will move from one place to another. And it just, everything is perfectly balletically, like there's a purpose behind all of it. None of it feels happenstance. Tati personally gave direction for physicality and for gait and for timing, not only to every single actor, but to every single extra. That's why, like, when everybody's on the dance floor at the restaurant at the end, why they all appear to be moving in unison and they're always popping into frame and somebody revealed behind somebody else, right, as they're, because it's just in one guy's head. Like, that's the kind of thing you would have an AD do. He personally went up to every single extra and said, here's how you will dance, here's how you will walk.
Speaking of physicality, and like, I just want to shout out one moment in that restaurant scene that just gave me the giggles. There are, but the one where I think it's the second drunk guy at the bar to fall over.
Uh-huh.
And the waiter flips over the bar stool and picks him up inside of the upturned.
Well, because all the bar stools are way too tall, but it's like the like the tall legs, and then they've got like the metal rings around them, yep. And he just stands them up perfectly like, inside and slides them back up to the bar. Cage,
and he's so just, funny. That shit is hysterical.
Yeah,
that had me howling.
Plot schmott or whatever, but like Monsieur Hulot and this woman Barbara, they both land at the airport. He's bumbling around. She's with a group of other American tourists who are all like, it's basically all women, except I think there's one dude and like their tour guide group. And like, yeah. They're all like, oh, look over there. It's this. And it's just like very transparently, like somewhat disdainful of the American tourists, which is fine. It's an easy group to make fun of, especially when they all climb onto a bus and then they're excited by the parking lot that they drive by.
Yeah.
But so the two of them, like their paths kind of intersect a few times.
And there are long sequences in this movie where we don't see either of them.
Yeah. We're just observing behavior and seeing the world. But it all climaxes in this, like, I think it's 40 minutes long. I clocked it. It starts about the hour mark in a 2-hour movie. The two of them separately arrive at the grand opening of the Royal Garden restaurant, brand new restaurant that's opening up. The paint is literally drying on the walls.
They haven't finished the kitchen. Oh God, it stresses me the fuck out. The
staff is clearly not trained. The architect has made a bunch of like aesthetic choices that no one thought about at all. All of their like wrought iron chairs that have like the crown logo into the back keeps tearing everybody's
suit jackets.
This is the thing that makes me laugh the most is the one waiter who like, he's trying to squeeze past the table and the chair tears at his pants, and so he ends up outside on the garden, and then one of the other guys comes by and he's like, what are you doing out here? He's like, oh, I'm outside on the garden, my pants tore. He's like, hey, can you go help me out? Sure. And then a guy comes back a few minutes later and he's got torn pants, or yeah. No, he's got a torn jacket, and so they switch jackets. And then another guy comes out and his shoe has ripped because the lighting on the one step keeps going out, and so they trade shoes.
And then another guy has a tie
that fell in the sauce. Yep. And there's a poor bastard, and then of course he finally ends up like coming back in and joining a raucous party as the restaurant literally falls down around them.
I like the like wall part falls down and the manager is playing it off like it's a VIP area.
Well, he's not the manager. He's like, he seems like he thinks he's the owner, but he just strikes me as like every rich douchebag who just walks around and thinks that he owns the place.
Sure.
But yeah, he's like, no, this is a VIP place. And the only people who can come in are the ones whose jackets or backs have been scarred by these chair patterns. Oh my God. It's so good. And then there's just shit in it that like is jaw dropping to me. The whole sequence that plays out in a high angle wide shot where Monsieur Hulot is trying to track down the guy that he came to like interview or something with.
Who's got the blue folio or whatever. Yeah.
And we watch it from this high angle looking over this huge room of cubicles. And we watch it all play out as they just like bounce around and follow the paths and make a phone call from one cubicle to the other.
And it's
all perfectly timed. Like no fucking wonder it took 3 years because every single shot in it is enormously ambitious and perfect.
The sequence where Hulot ends up like having a scotch with that one guy and his family. And we're just watching all of the other families in the apartment building.
Yeah. We're watching four different families. They're all seemingly watching the same boxing match or something on TV. And we're watching from outside. We can only hear the sound of the streets. That's like a recurring motif in the movie is like, if the camera is placed outside, you can't hear what's inside the glass, even though every room that we see is floor to ceiling, wall to wall glass.
And you can see that people are interacting and talking and doing whatever. Yeah.
But he gets all this great like physical comedy out of like the people in the one side are looking at the TV and on the opposite side of that wall is a TV. And then the other family is looking at, but then the one family is reacting to the behavior of the other family, even though they're actually reacting to the television. Yep. Like it's so perfectly timed and it's so perfectly funny. And it like is a movie that, It just like, it gets me in like a deep and profound way. Like I would love to see what Jacques Tati would make of the modern world of 2022.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause like it is a deeply thoughtful movie about modernity and about like the homogenizing of world culture and making everything look the same just to appease like tourists who have money to spend, and this like this arch like staunch classism that just pervades everybody everywhere, and the whole like expo sequence where Monsieur Hulot is like bumbling through this expo of like modern home goods and inventions and shit. And all of it's the dumbest shit in the world.
The silent door.
The silent door that can't be slammed is so funny.
That's the sequence that I was referencing where they're speaking German. I was like, wait, are they, they're speaking German.
Yeah.
And they're going in and out of German and French and English and then slamming these doors that don't make a sound. Oh my God. And Hulot gets like confused when the guy disappears because he couldn't hear the door slam and the guy rip. It's fucking brilliant.
Yeah. It's really brilliant, but it's also like, it's, I find it deeply thoughtful every time I watch it. Like the, you're talking about the whole sequence, looking in on those families through their windows. A lot of the movie is scenes looking at stuff through a window or through a frame.
Yeah.
But I think that sequence in particular, it's kind of the linchpin to it all, which is that a lot of the movie, I think, is about television. And maybe that paired with the commentary about the Americans and the tourists is about this idea of like American media and American television being this like this monoculture creating thing that we're just right. all exporting it and we're all absorbing the same media and the same consumption. Honestly, and this is thoroughly metatextual. This has nothing to do with like anything I've read about Tati or anything, but like you could look at it today through the prism of social media. Everybody in their apartment, they're all staring at their screens and oblivious to the fact or indifferent to the fact that anybody walking by can see what they're doing. It is a world of total self-absorption and a complete lack of privacy that does not exist.
Yep.
And it's about isolation. We're absorbed in ourselves and we don't care that everybody can see that we're doing. And we don't care what anybody else is doing, but all you have to do is look and invade anybody's privacy.
Totally.
And then the restaurant sequence, which honestly, I felt bad. Like I was watching it last night and I'm like, oh man, Jamie is having a complete panic attack watching this sequence.
The moment they started letting guests into the restaurant,
oh, yeah.
I was like, no.
You can't.
No.
You can't don't do it.
Do it. Stop. Stop this right now. Immediately stop it. Now. No. Oh, oh God. But so then good. Like it escalates and you get into it and it, oh God. Oh my God. I almost forgot about the doorman, like the door that breaks and the doorman is just holding the knob and swinging it as though there's
no one notices except for the drunk people who just stumble right along past
it. Yep.
It's just like, it's so dense with comedy. And I found myself, especially in those really busy restaurant scenes of just like I would watch some sequences multiple times just to like, all right, I'm going to look in the bottom right corner here and just see the little like dramas that are playing out that you don't even notice. Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun. It definitely deserves several rewatches.
Well, and it's just, it's so delightful too. Like it's very pleasant to watch. It's not often laugh out loud funny, although
no.
I will have to seek out opportunities to see it theatrically. Like, oh man, if I could go to a place and see a 70mm print of this, with a crowd, I'm sure it would play like gangbusters. But yeah, it's just, it's constantly amusing and clever. And it's just, it's that thing of like musicals, right? That like, even if you're not like into the song that you're watching in a musical, if the choreography is good, it is aesthetically pleasing.
Right.
And the choreography of all of this is just astounding to watch. Even just the opening sequence in the airport. Like watching the one tourist group go and then the nuns whose nun hats have flapping bird wings on the side.
That was I was like, what am I watching something about like, are they in heaven right now? Cause I hadn't placed it in an airport at that point. Cause it doesn't look like a modern airport. I was like, what is happening? But then it escalates in density of extras and characters in that sequence, right? You start off just on the couple, the guy with the scarf and the cigarettes and whatever. And then like more people walk on and off and then it like sort of crescendos to like a big crowd, which is super duper cool. Although I will say I had not yet understood what I was watching at that point. So I was like, what the fuck is happening? I don't know what I'm watching. I don't know who I'm supposed to be following. I don't know what information I'm supposed to be retaining.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm very confused.
And if you like Tati's films, if you had seen other Tati movies, then so there is a guy who pops up a couple of times throughout the airport sequence who is mistaken twice for Hulot. Before he ultimately identifies, he's like, oh, I'm not Hulot. My name is Smith. And you think in these long wide shots where he's very far away from the camera, based on his wardrobe and his body language, like he is moving very much in the way that Tati always did as the character. And so it's like, it's faking you out and it gives you somebody to latch onto. Like you're like, oh, that it's a Where's Waldo thing. That's Monsieur Hulot. Great. Oh, and then he just disappears from the frame again.
Right.
And then he pops up again and then, oh, nope, he's gone again. What am I? And then he finally reveals himself and then the real Hulot shows up and he is accidentally getting off the trolley. He has locked umbrellas with the fake Hulot and then the two of them part ways. Like he's just having fun, like goofing on people and playing on the audience's expectations and then just goes wild. I watched a chunk of it with my son. Something he clocked right away is Hulot goes to the office building or whatever to meet with so-and-so bureaucrat or like middle management guy. And they put him in a waiting room, right? They put him in a glass waiting room.
Yep.
And he's just slowly doing circles of the glass waiting room and like playing with all the chairs that make fart noises every time, which are the only chairs that we like basically ever see until the restaurant.
Yep.
They're in that office. They're in the guy's apartment.
They're in the expo.
Yep. These like terrible, fucking ugly modern chairs.
And they keep squishing them down and then they wait.
Making the fart noise.
And then they
every time.
Pop back up.
Yeah. But the thing that my son clocked is that all of the portraits in that room of like the titans of industry or whatever, as Hulot walks around the room and as he walks past those portraits, they are always filmed at an angle at which the fusty, you know, mustachioed, balding, like white man in the portrait of like the four or five portraits is always staring at him and is always in some way the expression on his face is reflective of like confusion or revulsion or annoyance at what Hulot is doing. And it's something I never noticed in like the two times that I had watched the movie previously. And my kid clocked it right away. He's like, oh, it looks like he's staring at Mr. Hulot. And then in the next shot, and now he's looking at him too.
That's so funny.
It's so good. And the music is great. God, the whole in the restaurant sequence, when like the full band that's just like when they're going wild and the tension is ratcheting up as the band is playing a song that feels like it goes on for a full 15 minutes.
Yep.
As the restaurant is falling apart, as the electricity is breaking down.
They're like handing food out of a window that is basically just plywood. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm just so stressed out about this fish that hasn't gotten to the table.
Or the fish that had been seasoned by every member of the service staff and never served to anyone.
Which, oh God, that was really tweaking me out, dude. I was not okay.
Have you ever been on the receiving end or on the managerial end of somebody taking what I'm assuming is like the tucked away in a corner bottle for service staff and putting black grease or black marker on the tip of it to tip you off to anybody who's taken swigs behind the doors?
No, but that shit was funny.
It was very good.
I had a lot of fun. And every time I remember something about the movie, I smile. It was a pleasure to watch.
Playtime. People should check it out. I am a big fan. We've already presaged this conversation a little bit. Do you think the wine pairs with Playtime?
No, you need something that you can sip on for 2 hours.
Yeah.
You need something that like can go the distance, that maybe has a little bit less going on than this wine, you know, because there's so much going on in Playtime. You need. I don't know, Vino Verde or Albarino or something with maybe a little spritz, something that's, you know, you want something with low alcohol because you want to sip on it for the entire time, but like so something a little bit simpler. I don't think that this is a good pair.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even want to finish the glass that's in front of me, but it's a healthy pour and I've already had a few drinks. I think rhetorically it is an excellent pairing. Your words balanced high acid against serious sugar content. The acidity is the bite.
Right.
Is the worldview of the movie that is almost despairing.
Yes.
But then the sugar is the funny and the joy and the joie de vivre. The bright citrus is all the high tones and the comedy and the gorgeous choreography.
Also the color.
Well, all right, we should talk about the color then. What color do you think is in the movie? Because there ain't much. Tati, his whole
there
thing was that
pops, and that's what I'm referring to. That the blue of the parcel or I feel like Barbara is carrying something orange at some point.
Well, and then her green dress,
her green dress
that really pops in a huge way.
But other than that, yeah, it's like gray.
He apparently said he wanted to make a black and white film that was filmed in color. And it is a world almost completely devoid of color, except for a few like very banal objects like a blue folder or like red lights on the air conditioning system or something.
The red of the restaurant's neon sign. And then the gift that he gives her at the end is also wrapped in blue.
A beautiful parcel.
And it ends up being a handkerchief.
It's a lovely scarf that she wears over her head. And then with a little flower tucked inside,
yep,
which is one of the only plants featured in the whole movie. Otherwise, everything is gray.
Yep.
A surprisingly gorgeous movie for being so monochromatic, and where the gray of everything is like draining. You know, it's a thing back when I used. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it just reminds me of like when I used to live in Philly, and then I would leave after, you know, a few weeks of not having left the city, and then I would cut out and, you know, into the burbs or whatever. I'm like, oh, right. Green. Sometimes the city can feel that way.
Yeah.
It can just feel fucking gray and oppressive. Especially in this one where like everybody just wears gray overcoats and black clothing.
It very much, I mean, speaking of Philly and also of New York and, you know, Northeast cities, DC, in the wintertime, everyone's wearing black and gray, and the sky is gray and the buildings are gray, and this is why we get depressed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rhetorically good pairing. I think that you took the pairing words that I gave you and applied them well, but in practicality, sitting there
does not work.
No,
no. Too much sugar.
Honestly, beer would be great with that movie.
I could have gone for a nice scotch, actually.
Mm.
I still have that bottle of Amrut downstairs. I should have poured myself one of those.
That was another thing. That dude invites Hulot in for a scotch, and they don't have a scotch. They sit there in front of the TV. And like his daughter brings out snacks that they don't eat.
Does he not pour him a drink?
No.
Or he pours himself a drink?
No, huh. No bottle appearance that I clocked.
And you would have noticed.
I would have.
That's something you notice is when bottles appearance.
And then he invites him in for another scotch. And I'm like, you didn't have one.
You didn't have a drink the first time.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. That sequence is a knockout to me. I saw that sequence years and years before I ever saw this movie. Steve Arnold showed it to me.
Friend of the pod.
Yeah, he was just like, we were talking about like direction, and we were just like talking about scenes that we liked. And he was like, here, he pulled it up on YouTube. And he's like, just watch this sequence. And we're like, oh my God, I didn't know you could do this. Look how much fucking shit is happening in this frame at any given moment. And you just get to pick what you want to look at. And you get to follow your own little stories. But it is exhausting. Freedom of choice is not something we are accustomed to.
No.
As contemporary American moviegoers.
Nope, not at
the
all.
The movie is supposed to tell you what the story is and who the important character is, and it holds your hand and it guides you along.
As was my struggle in the beginning of this movie.
Yeah.
Not knowing what I was going into. I was like, what am I paying attention to? And then you realize it's everything.
Or nothing. Well, I'm glad you liked it. I'm glad you liked Playtime.
I'm glad you liked this movie. Or this, what, fuck. I'm glad you liked this wine.
It was good.
Yeah.
I feel like you should have liked Playtime more, but we'll give you that opportunity on your next viewing. There's also a pretty high bar to set for me for future movie selections for the show. No exaggeration. I think this is one of like the single best movies ever made. I think it's easily the best movie we've talked about on the show.
Really?
Yeah. Different things do different things, but hang on, let me just pull up the list. I'm trying to think of anything we've done on the show that I think is better than Playtime. The closest to second place is Mad Max Fury Road in terms of just like singular superlative greatness. Not to say that I have to keep topping ourselves, because like I'm not making these things, you know, we select what the pairing is, but yeah, this is a peak. Playtime.
Good conclusion to the mini.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of had to be the last one. I knew I wanted to end here just because I didn't
dessert.
Want, well, it is dessert. It's Playtime. it's just play and it's graceful.
Yeah.
It's something Tati said, that like plot is a distraction. Plot means the audience is paying attention to who's this character and where is the story going and what's going to happen next. And the more plot there is and the more narrative complications you have, the less time he has for gags. And so right. If you get rid of plot as much as possible, you can just have gags. And for comedy, like gags is what we want. You just want gag.
Say gag one more time.
No.
All right, Scotty, what is next time?
Well, Jamie, we're taking a little break ski here.
Taking a little summer break.
I don't know if you knew this. I knew this.
We have discussed
you
this.
You seem to not know since you were asking me what was next.
I was setting you up, man.
Oh, that was terrible. Guys, it's warm in here. Jamie's getting sweaty. He's running out of things to say. He's had too much dessert wine. He's getting sleepy. He needs a nap time.
Got a little headache starting.
Yep, from all that sugary wine. Sugar, yeah. It was very wet, not dry.
Not dry.
But yeah, we're taking a little bit of a break, a little bit of a hiatus. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with a brand new miniseries about... TBD.
Scotty's going to be leading this one.
We're going to figure it out. We got some options, some things that are to various degrees of half-baked, and we'll see where the spirit takes us. But for now, you know... Go back, listen to some old episodes, watch Jacques Tati's playtime a few times, and enjoy yourselves. And yeah, we'll see you guys in a couple of weeks. Jamie, let's put a period on it now. How do you feel about your Philadelphia tasting menu?
I feel great.
These are the only six Philadelphia restaurants that anyone needs to go to this summer.
Oh no, there are a bajillion restaurants out there.
Well, then why didn't you recommend them?
Because we do miniseries of 6 episodes in length, generally speaking.
That feels like an arbitrary excuse making.
Well, I mean, but also like these are restaurants that are near and dear to my heart and largely restaurants that I have a personal connection to. Obviously, Southwark being the one that I have the strongest personal connection to, but everyone that I've highlighted here is a place that is owned by a friend of mine or by people who I feel connected to on an ethical or personal level. The restaurants that I frequent, these are foods that I eat a bunch. And so it was a Philadelphia tasting menu, but it was also a little bit of Jamie tasting menu.
You know, I could see where that sentence was going when you started it, and I hoped you weren't going to go there, and then you did.
Dear listener, you can infer anything you like from what I just said.
From the Jamie tasting menu.
That's right.
Yep. And none of you had the experience that I just did of Jamie suggestively parting his knees while saying a Jamie tasting menu. Oh, boy. Well.
I didn't part my knees while I said that. Yes, I've been sitting legs akimbo for quite a while.
Parted a scant amount more. You were very pleased with yourself.
I usually am.
All right. Well, now tell me how I did, Jamie, because I think you picked good foods and I liked them all. And for once, I liked all of these wines.
I think you did. I think you did really good, except for pig, which I didn't like.
But what about exploring the power of food? We explored so many aspects of the power of food.
We did. We definitely did. We explored the like Baroque opulence of pastry with Marie Antoinette.
The deliciousness of man flesh with raw.
Oh my God. Fucking hell.
And then the glory of going to a restaurant where no one has their shit together and everything explodes around you.
Yep. Yep.
It seems like a really dumb industry you've picked to work in, my friend.
It's real bad.
Yeah.
If I had it to do over again, I might choose differently.
You know what you could do?
What's that?
You could pack up your bags and leave the city and go and live in a cabin by yourself with a pig.
Not going to do that,
a
Scott.
A very rational, emotional decision that anyone with a basic level of empathy could understand another person doing.
No, it's bad and dumb and unhealthy.
All right. Well, come back in a few weeks where we're going to do a series of movies that I will pick specifically to put Jamie on the wrong side of opinion. God.
Yeah, it'll be the Sad White Man series.
No, I'll pick other things as well.
Great.
But just anything to make you sound wrong and dumb.
Sure. Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you so much. This has been a little bit of an experimentation. little bit of a dabbling, doing something new, mm-hmm. adding a third heat to the show.
That's right. The Trivection Oven.
The Trivection Oven. And yeah.
We hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed doing it.
I hope you guys ate the food in addition to watching the movies and drinking the wines.
And if you didn't, you should endeavor to do so.
Yeah,
visit these restaurants.
Go get those bao buns. Get the babka. Yep. Oh, get all that pasta.
So thanks everyone for joining us. Follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us with any comments, questions, concerns, or international reviews that you'd like us to read on the show. We're still going to continue in our carrot and stick segment where you can force me to watch MCU movies and I will gnash and whine about them, or Scott will visit the wrath of his home renovation travails upon us.
Hey, you know what? Some people like that. Friend of the show, Wendy, when I saw him most recently,
yes.
He's like, oh, let me see your bathroom. I really want to know what's going on. Some people are good friends, Jamie.
Some people like that. They're weird.
Yeah.
And remember to tell your friends about the show.
Tell your friends about
rate,
the show.
Rate, review, follow, tell your friends.
This episode was produced and edited by me. That's Scott Hudson. Our social media presence is thanks to Jamie, Jim Jamborino, Harrison Rubin, Esquire.
I guess that's me.
The third. And our art is thanks to Ross Connard. Thank you so much, Ross.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine, watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
All right, goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
You know this is just a hiatus, right? This is just a pause. You just seem very deflated in the last 5 minutes, and I'm concerned.
No, I know that this is a hiatus. We're going to be back.
You just seem very sad, like you're saying goodbye to something.
Scott, I'm tired.
I'm so tired. I've had to sit down and talk for 4 hours.
It was a lot.
No.
It was a lot.
I'm very warm and sweaty, though.
Yeah, it's warm in here. I've had wine. It's nap time.
I'm so tired.
It's nap time, Scott.
So tired. Guys, Jamie's going to miss talking to me for several hours every Friday.
Oh, it's going to be
gonna miss it so much.
Not have to listen to your stupid ass voice.
I'm still going to call you and tell you about the bathroom, though.
Oh, great.